creation, given what surrounds them. And we have applied that prime industrial overlay as a protection for with, if and when it changes, it gets those restrictions. But that has initially triggered a lot of questions about, oh, you're changing me to industrial. Well, no, we're not. You're okay as you are. It could change in the future, but it raised a lot of concerns that we handled through our hotline to try and talk through those issues.
Would you just could you just go back to the Central East Side Subdistrict, which I notice is outlined here? What are the regulations proposed for that? Why is the Central East Side Subdistrict outlined in red?
Oh, that's for the change to expand the industrial office use allocation in that area.
What's the objection to our prohibition on self-service storage, since these are facilities that don't generate any jobs, and they're in industrial areas where we're focused on growing middle-income jobs? So what's the objection to our prohibition?
They make a lot of money. You know, they're a lucrative business, and we would be pushing them into the commercial mixed-use zones, in which then they have to pay commercial residential development land prices.
But I mean, the tension here is that these things, I have a little experience with this on an unrelated matter here, I mean, in a city thing, but I mean, these self-service storage units, yes, basically don't create any jobs.
Right. That's why we're saying in our employment areas, we don't want to see those. You're okay in the commercial districts, but you know, you have to compete with those other uses, the retail uses and the residential uses, for that. You have to pay those land prices. I will say what we are starting to see is sort of the three-story model for the self-storage. So we are seeing increased density there.
I wonder if there's a content-neutral way to tax those things and use the money for economic development. That's your charge for the weekend, Mr. Commissioner.
As long as they're not in industrial sanctuaries.
Yes. Okay. Map issues.
Take something out of each self-storage facility and sell it.
There you go. That's a TV show. Map issues. I think we've had some. We haven't had a lot of testimony on these map changes, but we have had individual property owners come forward. We did have a discussion about where to change the EG zone along Northwest Vaughan and what that meant for the transportation capacity. And there's a change coming up under miscellaneous to address some of that. Again, sort of just people, I guess, wanting to revisit the comprehensive plan map decisions and wanting something more than the EG zone that they're getting. Is there any questions about the employment code changes?
Could you just remind me about the industrial office use? What's the difference? What does that allow?
Yes.
They're typically what brokers call creative offices. They're primarily software and design-related firms, like architecture, engineering, and industrial design firms. And traditional offices are distinguished. That includes medical offices, dental offices, financial banks, government offices. So those are not included.
So how do we know what they're doing inside the building?
It can be a challenge for enforcement over time when tenant improvements aren't being proposed. So it's enforcement is done on a complaint-driven basis, and there are a lot of cases in the Central East Side where we see traditional offices in these areas.
Excuse me. Okay.
Other questions, or
we'll move on to the campus institution package.
Okay.
And John Cole will join us, and he has led a four-year effort in working with the hospitals and colleges and the neighborhoods that surround them to come up with these elements. Again, we're talking about what we have are 16 dispersed colleges and hospitals throughout the city. This does not include PSU. It does not include OHSU. because they either have their own plan district or their own, they're part of the central city planning. But through the comp plan, we created a new map designation campus institution. And so now we have two zones, base zones, to implement that map designation. And the base zones really are sort of based on the character of a more residential campus, like a Reed College or a Lewis and Clark or University of Portland, or an urban campus, which is most of our hospitals, PCC Cascade, PCC Southeast. And so we've come up with a bunch of different, slightly different development standards and allowed uses around retail and service and office and orientation to the street and development intensity, depending on which type of campus you are. What we've really tried to do on is set a sort of overall development envelope, and this was really modeled after the last University of Portland master plan, in which one of the problems that we were trying to solve here is under the current conditional use master plan process, universities, colleges hospitals have to project out 10 years out what they're going to do and where they're going to do it. And if they have to move the building, if they decide they want to be one floor bigger, they have to go through a type 3 master plan amendment process. And that was being seen as really burdensome process in what might be a minor change. And University of Portland tried this new model where basically if it's in the interior of campus, they have a lot more freedom to move their buildings around and program around and really focus on the edge of the campus and on the offsite impacts, and which is how we're trying to steer these base zones that would apply to all 16 campuses, which is to give them more freedom in terms of how they use their development space on their campus, but be a little bit more prescriptive on how they interface with the neighborhood, and over time continue to monitor and require the transportation impact reports that they currently have to do as part of the conditional use master plan.
So we currently, I think, we have had discussions with Parks SDCs with campuses, and their claim that because they're providing lots of open space within the campus, they shouldn't be required to contribute as much in system development charges for parks. How would we manage that issue? They're allowed to do a lot if they're not required to go through a design planning thing for the inside of the campus.
Manage like public access to their facilities, or
making sure that they've got enough open space.
Well, that's where we set these the floor area ratio standards on page 5. In terms of, you know, the especially the residential campus, that 0.5 to 1 is basically where we're at currently in the residential zones in terms of how intensely you could develop a single family lot in the city. And we sort of based it off of that. It gives them a little more breathing room than they currently have, but it is not a, you know, massive development build out like you see at PCC Southeast. The 3-to-1 is similar to what we have in our mixed-use zones and what we have in our commercial zones today.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. Yeah. What about not requiring pedestrian standards in residential campuses?
The pedestrian standards refer to the pedestrian orientation for buildings fronting sidewalks. And what we found, you know, like if you think about Reed College or University of Portland, those are set back from the street. They tend to have a nice green buffer around them.
Which is PCC Sylvania?
They are currently a residential campus. We expect a request from them to be a urban campus.
Well, I have a request from me to make them have sidewalks that connect from the sidewalk on the street to the places you want to go.
Right. This pedestrian standards don't refer to sidewalks per se. The sidewalks around the frontage, around the perimeter of the campus and connecting to their buildings. That's all sort of part of the transportation review. We're talking about how their buildings orient to the street.
Well, I'd like more discussion about that.
We'll make sure that what you were talking about, that we cover that in transportation, and we'll talk to your staff about that one.
Thank you.
About surveillance.
Yes.
Yeah. I would just add, since you brought that up,
I just want to mention, since you were talking about Sylvania, that it happens that today and tomorrow they're in a two-day planning charrette on their campus, which is open to the public about the future of the campus, and that's being done in conjunction with Metro and TriMet because of the Southwest Corridor transit project. So that if you have time to stop by and participate in that, or send staff.
Only I had a waking hour that I was actually spending at home. That would be lovely. Yeah. Good.
As I said, with the new development, one of the things that we really focused on is the transition from the edge of campus, and what as buildings get closer to the edge of campus, having them step down in height to match the scale of the zone that may be across the street or adjacent to the campus, to provide a more prescriptive, here's how you will step back and allow the taller buildings at the interior of campus, but as you get to that edge, to be more in scale with the adjacent residential uses. As part of this, we are applying these two zones to the 16 campuses. The example on the right is Providence Medical Center right now, and you can see that they have, what is it, 5 different zones that they're covered currently under the conditional use master plan. The underlying zones occasionally cause them some difficulty, and so this just sort of provides one rational designation for the entire campus. One of the big issues that we encountered at the PSC in talking about is how do we transition from the current conditional use master plans and the impact mitigation plans to these new base zones. And what we came up with was as these plans expire over the next few years,
or 20 years ago,
or something like that, that basically you have until 2023, the end of 2023, to get on board with the base zones. And so between now and then, you have an option. You could do a 5-year master plan if you wanted to still go through that conditional use master plan. If you have one now, like the University of Portland or Providence, we're going to let you run with that if you want. We think the base zone is a better option. And as we implement this and people learn how to use it, we hope that it will be more attractive. But we went back and forth as, should it be 2020? Should it be 2023? Where should we land? The PSC has recommended 2023. It lets pretty much everybody with a CUMP finish their current development program without having to go through a change, and it gives them plenty of notice to get ready for the new set of regulations.
So what about the 6 that are already expired and we haven't apparently passed?
So those, they haven't had a lot of development activity, and basically BDS is waiting for them to come in to propose something, and then they'll have to do an update to their master plan. Or they can go for conditional uses for individual buildings, on a piecemeal basis. Or come 2018, when this is available, the base zones are available, then they can develop under these base zones.
Just a question. It's long been my view that we, as a city, tend to undervalue the presence of all these distinguished colleges, universities that are here, in the sense that some of them actually used to take pride in being here, but not necessarily of here. Now that's changed. The promotional material really highlights the fact that they're in Portland. University of Portland has done this. They've rebranded themselves as really being part of Portland. But the question I had is, there's a lot of construction going on in these campuses. And, they're raising money from students across the country, building endowments, and then doing a lot of construction. So there ought to be some way to quantify the economic, positive economic impact of all that work, because it is, it's one of those hidden dividends, it seems to me, of having all these distinguished colleges and universities here, that they're going through a big capital program, a capital spending plan. They're building a lot of stuff. They're putting people to work. We're collecting fees, thankfully. But there's an overall economic impact of what they're doing. Can we quantify that?
We could. We haven't quantified the sort of construction aspect of that. But the reason we've invested so much time as part of the comp plan process in these campus institutions is because over the last 10 years, it's been the fastest growing job sector in the city, and we expect that to continue. And it's a source of good jobs, both sort of high wage jobs and the middle wage sort of administrative jobs as well. And so,
and probably OHSU is a big driver in that. But anyway, without commissioning a study, at some point I'd just be interested in having some back of the envelope way of quantifying economic impact, because the mayor talks about how few cranes there were in the air before he was elected. He came in, now there's a crane on every corner. You can draw your own conclusion from that, but there is so much activity going on in these campuses, and I think it's another way we could celebrate what it means to have all of these institutions in our backyard that are expanding, investing. I'd love to have some way of getting a back of the envelope number.
We'll see what we can come up with. As I said before, you know, we with these zones, we're focusing on the edges of campus and that interaction with the neighborhood. And the other thing that we're sort of keeping as part of the conditional use process is a periodic transportation impact review. Every 3 to 10 years, the campuses have to come in and look at how much growth they expect, what that traffic impact is going to be, and in particular, a more formal requirement for a transportation demand management program to, you know, continue to reduce single occupancy vehicle trips to campus, what kind of transit, bike, pedestrian and car sharing incentives, carpooling incentives are they requiring. I would say that this is a program sort of being set up by PBOT on a more formal basis. Right now, you come in as part of a CUMP, you don't know what you're going to get in terms of TDM requirements. And so we're trying to provide a better guidance and more certainty about what you can expect. I think given that change, especially on the part of the institutions, there's a little bit of anxiety about that, and we'll hear some of that anxiety. In terms of what they're going to be required to do in the future, I guess they, as we've heard commonly, they want some flexibility, but they want certainty. And so we've been working with PBOT to try and work through that and provide guidance. You will see as part of the TSP package, there's an administrative rule with more rules around this TDM program and what the institutions are going to be required to do. I think the TDM is what we've heard most about from public testimony on part of the institutions. I think we have worked a lot in terms of just the base zone and what they're allowed to do and what they're not allowed to do. We've worked very closely with the institutions to try and both educate them on what the new zones mean, but also try and address their issues. We have a series of maps in the zoning code that sort of capture all of their special approvals, the extra height here or the special setback there. We've tried to capture that and incorporate that into the zoning code to get some of the uniqueness that is in the master plans today. I think some of the neighborhood associations like the conditional use master plan process. They like to really dig into, well, what is that building you're doing and how big is it and where is it going? And they're a little concerned that they're only going to get to really talk about the edges and the transportation impacts. And there's a trade-off there. I think we heard a lot about Emmanuel Hospital and their vacant blocks and what's happening in the future and how can we get more community uses in that. There's nothing in the zoning code that provides that direction. It's a continuing conversation between legacy and the community about what to do with those blocks. We did hear a lot more of wanting to codify a requirement for good neighbor agreements. It's something that the city attorney really didn't want to get into because the city isn't in a position to enforce those good neighbor agreements. So it is a encouragement. What we do have is we have a requirement for an annual meeting with the neighborhood on part of the institutions, and it's a best practice, and a lot of them do it. But in terms of codifying it as a requirement, it's not something that we're recommending and that the PSC recommended that we do just because we're not in a good position to enforce the terms of that agreement.
What about the Unity Center over near Providence, near...
It's a single facility.
Well, there's a several. It's by Cuyahoga Terrace.
I don't know that one.
Yeah.
It used to be the old State Hospital.
Old Holiday Park Hospital now becoming the Mental Health ER.
So
John, our standard was 10 acres and 100 employees?
We started by focusing on campus institutions that met that standard and then added the National University of Natural Medicine in response to testimony in front of this body.
It's still a campus. It's not a building.
So we were looking for larger sites to come under this. So we would have to look at what their base zone is and how they're operating. I would say, you know, one of the other things like that we looked at, you know, we didn't look at all institutions, just the big ones. And we did, as part of the comp plan, apply this to high schools. But we haven't written a zoning code for high schools yet. That's sort of on the list of things to do. As the next steps of implementation. And we haven't looked at other institutions like single medical clinics or churches or that sort of stuff. Okay, moving on. We have one more package. These are all the elements that got left behind. And so we have this miscellaneous zoning code update. There are a set of random things, stuff like, you know, we talked about what would be the appropriate zoning for Portland nurseries. And we said, well, we'll make them a conditional use in the residential zone. And so we have a little section on that. We had some concerns about all of the down zoning on steep slopes and whether we were making unbuildable lots as part of that. And so we have a provision that you can still get at least one house on those lots. These six things on the first slide were all part of the package and really didn't garner much in the way of public testimony or discussion. And we, you know, notified everybody that was involved, and nobody came to the PSC hearings. On the next page, next slide, the two things that did garner quite a bit of testimony were revising the set of maps that are in the RH zone. The RH zone has a base FAR of 2:1. It's a little bit different than the other residential zones. It's not units per acre, but we give a FAR there. And then we have a series of maps where we've allowed up to 4:1 FAR. And so I'll get into this in a moment, but we had quite a bit of testimony about that. We also have on the zoning map future trail alignments so that when private developers come in, we require that, depending on the type of and intensity of development, we require them to dedicate and build a trail. And we updated the major trail alignment map in the comp plan, and so now this was to change the zoning maps to reflect that. In terms of amending the set of 4:1 FAR maps in the RH zone, where we started was to amend the map by taking away 4-to-1 FAR areas where the RH was changed to some other zone. We had a lot of RH go to CM2 and CM3. We decided that that's a better fit. And so we were pulling these areas off the map to sort of reflect those changes. Well, as part of the testimony, we had a group from Irvington come in and say, you know, there's this is on slide 57. There's a strip of land just on the north side of Broadway, north of Schuyler, that really is the transition area between Broadway and the historic district. It's part of the historic district, and it's an area where we think 4-to-1 FAR just is too intense. It doesn't reflect the historic character. And so we considered that. We looked at that. We looked at sort of the scale of development. We looked at the opportunity for future redevelopment and thought that, yes, in general, this is a pretty good idea for that block north of Schuyler to go to 2-to-1 FAR in that area. And so we brought that map forward to reduce that 4-to-1 FAR area to sort of the area south of Schuyler, between Schuyler and Broadway. Well, when we did that, we had a new request come in from both the Alphabet Historic District and the Kings Hill Historic District to say, us too. Mm-hmm. We would really like to do that. And so the PSC was compelled by that testimony, and we went back and we looked at where the contributing structures were. We looked at how intensely developed it is. You know, what's at 2-to-1 FAR? What's at 4-to-1 FAR? Where's the location? And in the end, the PSC recommended not making a change in Kings Hill because of the tall buildings that are already there. There was less of a case of a uniform character of significantly less than 4-to-1 FAR. When we looked at the Alphabet Historic District, and these two maps are a little bit hard because the way they fall out in the zoning code, the registration is a little bit different. But the red star on that map is Cooch Park and the Metropolitan Learning Center. And where we landed was the area north of there inside the historic district, that would go to 2-to-1 FAR. And the area south of there, it's a little bit more intensively development. There's a few more vacant parking lots, and it's closer to the MAC station at Providence Park. We'll leave that 4-to-1 FAR. So that's their recommendation. I think I'm pretty safe in saying that the Northwest District Association is in agreement with that and likes that recommendation. But that's the change that we made there. On the update to the major public trail alignment, we had a lot of testimony on this. It sort of fell into two camps. We heard a lot from the 40 Mile Loop Land Trust and Southwest Trails. And there was a little bit of philosophical difference about what is a trail master plan map and what is a regulatory alignment that goes on the zoning map. We worked with them. We made a lot of changes to reflect both their concerns and to be a little bit more illustrative about connections and making connections and how it fits the larger picture, but still pretty focused on being that zoning regulatory. If you develop here, we want your trail. We would like to get a trail alignment there. We heard a lot of, or I would say a handful, a dozen property owners saying, hey, I don't want a trail on my property. There were probably a handful of cases that were corrections. Yes, you're right, the line belongs over here. But for the most part, the PSC has not recommended a change because these trail alignments got on a map through other public processes. We just didn't make them up. You know, they've been vetted through parks plans, through metro plans, and oftentimes they're segments of a larger trail, and it makes no sense to just exempt one property owner and cut out 100 feet out of a larger connection. And so for the most part, we have left those on the map. It's still open to negotiation when they come in for a development permit as to whether or not we can get an easement or require construction. It depends on the nature of development, primarily whether or not a land use review is required. There's a nexus there. So it's not a guarantee that we're going to make that connection, but it is certainly an indicator that it's something we're going to ask for. And as being part of the zoning map, it puts developers on notice that, that this is a big public concern on trying to make that trail connection. And that's what I have.
I want to make just one more note on the trails. Is one of the reasons we took on the trail question as part of the comp plan to begin with was through our capital planning process with the TSP and the CSP, we realized that Parks and PBOT had different trail plans that were slightly different. And we came to agreement that the city ought to really have one capital trail plan. And that's what really was the impetus to even have this in the comp plan process was bureau alignment of in the CSP.
So I have an issue, actually a set of issues I want to raise in terms of these sort of odds and ends. We haven't talked about it before. So one peril, you know, we always have when we're doing a big plan like this is that we create either through the plan and the code itself or through how the market works with it, a perverse incentive to do the wrong thing. So, for example, it has appeared that until very recently there was a perverse incentive to keep high FAR property in the central city in use as surface parking lots. That appears to be changing, hallelujah, in part by property owners' decisions, responsible, thoughtful property owners doing the right thing, and in part because the market lets them do more. So there are a couple of issues where I think we may be in that space here, and I'm wondering if we're properly positioned or whether we've addressed it fully. One is the drive-through issue, and I think we're on that one. Maybe what the Planning Commission has come up with is the eureka moment that will create the right incentives to head towards the development pattern that we want, as opposed to something else. The requirement for or the encouragement for platting street grids into big commercial sites, a la Hayden Island, good. I think we're sending the right signals there. One that we haven't even talked about that I'm wondering about, and that is billboards. It appears that there's a perverse incentive for some property owners who have rundown commercial or industrial property to leave it in a rundown commercial or industrial condition because of the very lucrative leases that they have with billboard companies for corners of the site. And if they were to build a building there or otherwise remove the billboard, they lose a no-work income stream. Is there anything that we are doing in this plan that will affect that? Is there anything that we should be doing in this plan that will affect that so that, again, we're building a dense, walkable, urban place with better design? We can't say chainsaw down your billboard tomorrow morning as much as we'd like to, but I just want to raise that issue. I think it was on Sandy Boulevard, and there's that infamous site over there with a little triangle of land with three billboards on it. Development happening all around, but there are those three billboards. I just wanted to raise that one. We haven't talked about it. It just occurred to me, but thinking about the weird side effects that we get sometimes from these plans, again, I think we may be onto something with what we're doing with drive-throughs. It appears that the parking lot incentive is no longer as great as the development incentive, so we maybe without much further work we'll get that one taken care of. But I wanted to at least raise the billboard issue because until now I hadn't thought about it.
The tricky part about that, and we'll have to do a little research, I think, but a number of years ago we removed the billboard and sign code from the zoning code and made it clear that it was no longer land use and that it was a separate question. So it's probably something that we can't do as part of the comp plan package. Or if we do something about it, we need to be very careful in that sense.
Yeah.
We can look at that. I would also add telecom facilities into that category because we're starting to see people. There's literally a building on Williams Avenue where they left the telecom cabinet on the corner and built the new mixed-use building around it. And so same dynamic.
Yeah, so I think we should look for those and think about are there things we can tune differently in this that would affect over the long run that property owner's decision to do what Greg Goodman is doing today, saying, okay, I'm going to go ahead and build what the city had in mind.
Not having it part of the land use code actually means we can potentially act on it more quickly.
Yeah, so at least I wanted to raise it and have us think about it. Other stuff that we ought to kick around for, this is really, really helpful to get this kind of uploaded before we get back into the gauntlet of the hearings process. So appreciate everybody's
time. Who will complain about what people will complain about?
Yes, that's most helpful, to be warned.
Mayor, so that I say one thing while I'm at the table to make it worthwhile having come up here. We do continue to work with institutions to try to get them to a comfort level with the campus institution zones, and they're putting us through our paces to do that. And one of the communications that I am struck by that they've made over the past months is we may see them as economic development players in the city, and they are, but they see themselves as something different. They, you know, their primary mission is either educating students or improving healthcare outcomes. Mm-hmm. So as I talk to them about these issues going forward, I acknowledge that that's their frame of reference, and it's improved my communications with them because of that.
Pay no attention to that $5 billion trust fund. Okay. Anything else?
This is the benefit of being in this job for a while, and you always say to say what I'm thinking, which is when you were talking about the benefits of the construction jobs, and which are huge, I think, and the huge benefit of the amazing number of jobs in both healthcare and the academic institutions, we don't get property taxes from any of them. And some communities around the country do. And they do it in something called a pilot, which is a property tax in lieu of taxes, or, you know, the payment in lieu of taxes. We've never had that conversation. Even bringing it up may put a, you know, bullseye on my back or something as I'm sitting here. But I feel like it's a responsibility that we should at least think about it. It's a lot of land, and the good that they're doing for all these other reasons may be why we don't do that, and that, so that it may be totally why we don't do that, but there are places that do around the country.
Yeah. Just following up on that with regard to transportation, I know that one of the side effects for actually mapping these facilities and these institutions on our comp plan map is that it makes them more visible to us when we're doing transportation planning. We can see that institution exists, and we don't forget that that's not just a residential zone over there.
Yeah.
So it puts more burden on us when we're updating the TSP to think about projects that we can build into the TSP that benefit connecting these institutions into the city. And as part of that, it should be two ways where we're talking to them about who's going to pay for that facility. And that the TSP does have a generic line item in the financial strategy for some financial agreements with institutions, a la what was done with the tram or other OHSU facilities. The same approach could be taken with other institutions as they grow in terms of development agreements.
Yeah, good point. They're huge transportation generators.
Thank you.
Great work, everybody. Thanks. Good job. Thank you. Well, there's some of those churches that have huge parcels, like the one up on top of Rocky Butte. You know that.
He's like, I don't want to talk about that right now. I got to go.
Michael Dinkins. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.